Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show, coming to you online at edexcellence.net. Please join me in welcoming my co-host, the only man I know who can get a mention of bars and alcoholics into an education-related quote in the New York Times, Rick Hess.
Hey, Mike. I guess I'm flattered, babe.
So, Rick, very impressive this week. You had a quote in a story about the economic stimulus. And you basically said what was this great metaphor you used?
I think I said, look, right, states and localities have built these unsustainable budgets. There's two ways the feds can get involved here if they're going to give money. One is they can just pump money out and hope things will eventually not be spent stupidly. Or two, they can actually put states and localities on a path to sustainability. And instead, they've chosen to just push the money out. Mm-hmm. And it's exactly like if you've got not even just a drunk, but an alcoholic wandering around the streets at 2 a.m., you can either send him home and put him to bed, mm-hmm. or you can say, you know what, we'll keep you out of trouble. We'll keep the bars open another hour. Mm-hmm. And I think I know which way we're going.
So Rick Hess wants to send the states to bed.
Without their supper, if need be.
Without their supper. Very nice. Well, that was lovely. Very well done, Rick. You know, this is very interesting right now in Washington. We've got, you know, this big stimulus package going through Congress. The House added some provisions that could be considered reform-minded, and then the Senate took them all out.
Stripped them.
So now it looks like the conference committee will compromise, most likely, between a bill that has a little bit of reform and a bill that has no reform.
Well, you know, and it's funny, out of the 80-odd billion that we're talking about for education, the total reform package was about $475 million to begin with,
right,
which is, you know, slightly over one half of 1%. And by getting the Harkins people and getting these tiny little reform driblets stripped out of the bill, what the blob is now insured is that the entire fight in conference will be, can we get our tiny little pieces put back? And nobody's going to have any energy to focus on kind of the big questions.
Mm-hmm. I'm telling you, you know, this all means that the Obama administration reformometer is not looking so warm these days. You can check that out on Flypaper, our blog. We are tracking all of the, you know, all the major activities and actions and proposals out of the Obama administration, as well as various rumors. I like to just put rumors up there on the blog.
What's a rumor that you've
well,
got?
Well, I heard yesterday, I was at the Gates Foundation meeting, you were there too, and I heard a rumor that Leonard Darling Hammond is going to be the deputy secretary. Now, it's just a rumor. It's all secondhand, third-hand stuff.
Shocking
rumor. But if
rumor.
It turns out to be true.
Where possibly could that one have come? Wow.
Right.
Wow, you were doing some investigative work
inside,
there, weren't you, babe?
On the inside, just like, you know, you hear rumors that Wendy Kopp was offered that job, turned it down.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's the kind of rumor
Lots
that we're
of rumors.
About. Lots of rumors. Okay, but we don't have time for rumors right now because we have a lot of substance to cover today.
Mm-hmm.
So let's go ahead and get started with Pardon the Gadfly.
Topic one. Legislators in Colorado are proposing a new law that would require companies to give their employees up to 6 hours a month of unpaid leave in order to attend parent-teacher conferences and other academic events at their children's schools. Is this a smart way to encourage greater parental involvement in education?
Yeah, it's not a bad idea. I think 6 hours a month sounds like it might be a little on the high end. I mean, people only work about 160 hours a month, so we're talking, you know, potentially a real issue. But this seems like a reasonable thing. If we're in this Obama era of mutual responsibility, employers making sure that parents can, that they have time to go to school events and meet with teachers, seems perfectly reasonable.
Now, of course, the business community has said that this is not reasonable, particularly for tiny little businesses that don't have any staff, don't have the staff to cover these kinds of shifts. But look, I think I agree. I think that this does make some sense. We can talk about, as a society, how can we make it more likely that parents can do their jobs effectively? And particularly if you're talking about low-income or working-class parents that are working, you know, one or two jobs and, you know, crazy shifts and a lot of night work, it makes it hard for them to be as involved with their parent.
Especially when you're talking single parents here, right? Mm-hmm. So that said, this is the kind of thing where you want to make exceptions for businesses under a threshold, whether it's under 50 employees or under 10 or something, because you can present real difficulties for certain kinds of businesses. Mm-hmm. And second, it'd be nice to see some actual evaluation to see whether there's actual real benefits coming out of this. One concern is that a lot of parents who might not have time also don't have transportation. So you might give them the time, but there's always a possibility that they're still not going to be able to get there, mm-hmm. or that this time might be abused in various ways.
Mm-hmm. Okay, topic number two, Christina. Oh, by the way, Rick, I want everybody to notice that we have two people that sometimes are called conservatives agreeing with the teachers unions in Colorado were the ones behind this proposal.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we're not predictable.
Well, you know what we say in our policy review piece, forthcoming in just a couple of days?
What is that, Rick?
We say that, you know what? We would all do a world of good if instead of reflexively dumping on the unions every time something came up, if we judge what the unions put forward on the merits, because once in a while, we think they make good points.
I love it. Topic number two, Christina.
Ohio's school voucher program is coming under fire now that test score results show participating students not performing well on the state's assessments. Is that a reasonable complaint or an unfair way to evaluate programs like these?
So a little bit of background here. This is the statewide voucher program in Ohio serving, I think, about 12,000 students. The law requires them to take the Ohio assessment. So for younger kids, the regular test used under No Child Left Behind. For high school kids, the Ohio graduation test. Now, those data then get sent to the state where basically nothing happens to them. But the Cincinnati Inquirer found a way to get a hold of those data and looked at them and found out, lo and behold, a lot of those students using the vouchers were failing those various tests. Now, what we don't know is anything about pre-test, post-test. We don't look at any value added over time, any growth. It's just a snapshot. And furthermore, these are tests that the private schools may not pay any attention to because they may have no relationship to their curriculum. So, Rick, is this totally unfair?
This is a ludicrous indictment of these voucher schools because, as you just pointed out, they're in no way, shape, or form. Is there any attention to whether the tests are aligned with what these guys are supposed to be teaching? But forget that. More fundamentally, we know the participants in the Ohio voucher program are low-income families with kids who are generally disadvantaged, performing poorly in school. You know, these results in isolation don't tell us anything. I don't think the voucher community or the choice community should be too quick to take offense. They've killed themselves in two ways here. One, that they have persistently fought efforts to actually get meaningful value-added assessments so that we could actually get a real metric on whether or not these kids are doing well. And second, just a couple of weeks ago, the Washington Post ran a front-page story on D.C. charter school community, for instance, in which they used cross-sectional level-based data, and several choice proponents were very enthusiastic about jumping on that train when it went in their direction. And so long as you're only paying attention to the numbers and they tell a story you like, you don't have a whole lot of credibility when you don't like the way the numbers come out.
Well said, Rick. Okay, topic number three.
All right. The New York Times reports about a new study showing an Obama effect on the test scores of African-American children, whereby their performance soared after seeing him get elected and sworn in as president. Could there be some truth to this?
Now, I know that Rick is going to express some skepticism here, okay, as he does about all things about our President Obama, it seems to me. But I think that there is, you know, this is very interesting. I mean, there is a body of evidence that says that, for example, if you ask African-American children to fill out on a test form what their race is before they take the test, they will do worse on that test than if you don't ask that question. And this relates to some sort of framing that happens. You know, African-American kids may believe that they are expected to perform worse because they are black and because they know that black students perform worse on these tests in average. So, you know, why isn't and this seems like this could be the case. If suddenly they see this very successful African-American man being, sworn in as president, that could have an impact.
Yeah, no. I mean, it's, you know, there certainly is a body of work, and this is, you know, plausible. Two things here, though. One, it's fascinating how fast New York Times is looking for evidence of the Obama resurrection of America. That not only is he going to, you know, fill our lives with joy and light, but, you know, a week into his administration, we're already seeing news stories about his healing touch upon the youth of black America.
Did you notice how cold it was on Inauguration Day? Global warming doesn't seem like a big problem anymore.
The more fundamental problem here is that this was such a ludicrous study for them to write the story about. As I understand it, it was done by some Ray Friedman at Vanderbilt University, with whom I'm not familiar. But the methodology of the study, apparently it was the entire study administered at 4 points in time was a total N of 88 African-American students, that the African-American students and the matched white students were all volunteers who were taking self-selected assessment. I understand that it may have been in a no-stakes environment. So for this kind of assessment to get this kind of attention, much less written up in the New York Times, as in any way indicative of Obama's national impact on African-American youth, I just think it says a lot more about the New York Times than it does about Obama.
Rick, you just sound like one of those skeptics that doesn't know that the ground has changed underneath their feet.
Yeah, you know.
Rick. But you know what? You did say something nice about the new era of mutual responsibility early on. So I'm not going to blast you as entirely anti-Obama.
Well, and the irony here is, of course, I've spent the last 8 years getting beat up for not being conservative enough by various people mm-hmm. in the conservative coalition. So I guess I am just always going to be one half step mm-hmm. out of the loop.
You're just Mr. No. That's what you're known as. Okay, well, that is all the time we have for Pardon the Gadfly. It's now everyone's favorite time. We know that because of our internal polling we've been doing. It is time for Amber's Research Minute. You know, that was a joke about internal polling, but I will say that last time on the show, we encouraged people to become a fan of the Education Gadfly show on Facebook, and many of you have done so. At last count, I looked, it was, I think, up to about 25 people who were fans. I'm very excited about that. I mean, that might sound small, but it's growing, and it's powerful, and I think this thing is about to take off.
Do they vote on which their favorite segment is? Did most of them say, my God, is that Research Minute,
no,
or is Rate That Reform?
We haven't, but maybe we can add a poll. That would be good. Yeah, we can add a poll to that. Mm. And I think it works. Look, I've got this friend of mine from high school who from elementary school, who is now a principal up in Frederick County, Maryland. And I think, you know, she saw me mention that I am a fan of the show, which I know is a little bit, you know, silly to become. I don't know if like J-Lo is her own fan on Facebook, for example. But look, give me some license here. Anyways, she saw that and she ended up listening to the show. She loves it. So look, this is how it works. This is the new way, Web 2.0. It's a beautiful thing. And yet, you know what, Amber?
What's
Rick
that?
Hess refuses to join Facebook.
I don't know why he'd have, like, hundreds of friends instantly.
I know. He's so well-connected. People would be all over that. Rick, get with the picture. It's a new era. Okay, Amber. So, what is the topic this week?
All right. This week, we've got the results from the USDOE's National Longitudinal Study of NCLB for 2006-2007. Now, I know it sounds pretty dry. But there are some descriptive data in there that are good to be aware of. First, no one has a clue about how much money is spent on professional development in schools. Case in point, district records report that Title II contributes $518 million of the total federal PD funding to districts from the programs reviewed. But when you talk to the Title II district coordinators who actually run the program, they say it's $959 million, which is an estimate that is 81% more than the district records. The study analysts say the discrepancy is likely because PD expenditures are not clearly identified in district accounting records. You think? Moreover, most of the Title II funding goes to class size reduction, we find out, not PD per se, which makes sense because the report also finds that the highest and lowest poverty schools now have the same student-to-teacher ratios. Finally, and this is sort of surprising given NCLB testing,
5 seconds.
We find that teachers are less likely to report participating in PD covering in-depth reading and math subject matter than they are to participate in PD that covers instructional strategies, which means PD is more about pedagogy and less about content. So, overall, disturbing news on the national PD front.
That's depressing.
Wasn't that crazy, though, that PD expenditure data? It's just nuts.
No, nobody knows. Nobody knows what we're spending on this.
No idea.
A lot of money. Nor what it is. Instructional strategies. What is that?
What does that mean?
We have no idea.
Mm-mm. Well, it doesn't mean in-depth reading and math content, though, because they were specifically asked about that.
You know, what's most terrific here, though, is when you talk to these folks in districts and they'll tell you that they're now you're doing data-driven professional development, but they don't actually know how much they're spending exactly on different kinds of professional development, and they can't match that onto the actual impact of professional development. So I'm entirely unclear as to what it means when they tell us that they're doing data-driven professional
development.
What
they're doing is they're doing professional development about data. You just heard them wrong.
Yeah, it's crazy.
But the other thing is the class size piece. I mean, here we are. It is 2009, okay? The Bill Clinton class size reduction initiative was when? In 1998, perhaps?
Mid-90s.
Right? 97, 98. It is still with us.
Yep.
I mean, for the last 10 years, I don't know how many people have screamed from the mountaintops, teacher quality is way more important than class size reduction, and yet districts spend the money on class size reduction.
They do.
Why is it? Because they have, it's now baked in. People are being paid out of this money.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Amber. Well, that's depressing. So do you have a nice peppy song for
us? Well, kind of peppy. Since the PD data are all over the map, we have Land of Confusion by Genesis.
Good song.
This is the world we live in.
We liked that one, didn't
we? We loved that one. We had a real jam session.
Yeah, we got our dance on.
That takes me back. God, that was, remember that? That was a great video. They had all the little puppet heads.
Oh,
they had
right.
Reagan, and the bird blew up in the end, and they had Gorbachev. It was awesome.
That sounds familiar, though. I never got to watch MTV.
This was old school MTV. This was probably like late 80s MTV.
Yeah.
That album came out, what, like 88, give or take?
86.
Wow.
Yeah. I was a youngin'.
Wow.
Yeah. Or to bring it back to education, just 3 years after A Nation at Risk. Thank you, Amber, for that depressing news. Okay, now we are on to rating that reform. Stafford, I should have a feeling that you might have a dandy for us today.
I do have a dandy for us today, but before we get started on the subject of really depressing news, mm-hmm. that song that you guys just listened to yes. came out the year I was born.
Yeah.
Moving right along.
Wait, is that supposed to be depressing for us or for
yes.
you?
Yes.
No, it makes me feel that much wiser.
Oh, okay. Well,
we've lived twice your life almost. So now you have to listen to us when we give you advice.
That's right.
Absolutely.
I hadn't been doing that already,
of course. Okay. Well, I tend to pick on bus drivers, and I'm going to pick on them again this week because first we had the bus driver, if you remember, a couple weeks ago, who stopped her bus on the train tracks to get her kids in the back to shush, and then the train came. And then we had the bus driver who made a stop at a liquor store before her pickup at 7 in the morning. And then she got caught because, you know, she was in a big yellow bus. Well, today...
Oh, in Stafford. I mean, back when we used to do News of the Weird, we also had some bus stories. I remember one where the bus driver got out at a gas station, I think, and the bus started going downhill with him not in the bus.
Well, I think Jeff
Cooner
probably...
And a kid had to go grab the wheel and stop.
Well, I think Jeff Cooner pink slipped a bus driver or two in his day, too, I believe.
So, yes. But, so this is a long tradition here on the show.
Okay. Well, good. I'm glad to hear that.
I'm upholding the tradition.
Well, today we have a bus driver who, like our previous offenders, was suffering from a case of disruptive students. That's always the case, isn't it? And they're screaming, they're yelling, and they're pushing her buttons. And Julietta Clinton, who drives a bus in Huntley, Illinois, had had enough. So what does she do? Well, all the kids were quite small on this bus. They were 5 to 10 years old. So she figures she'll just, you know, shake them up a bit. So what does? She slams on the brakes to knock them out of their seats. She had 54 kids on the bus, according to reports, and 18 of them were treated at the scene and one went to the hospital. And Clinton's attorney is maintaining that the incident was a quote-unquote accident. But as far as I know, accidents like braking hard enough to throw 5-year-olds out of their seats don't happen twice. Because that's right, folks, she did it twice. So I have to admit that being distracted while driving, on a more serious note, is a serious problem. In fact, some states are considering banning all cell phone use in cars, not just handheld cell phones, because apparently it is the distraction of the brain that is the issue, not the fact that you have something in your hand. So I'm going to give her an A for trying to quiet down the kids. That's a good problem to solve. As for how she goes about it, I mean, do we even need to?
But no dreaded double
seatbelts,
F this
folks.
Week. No dreaded double F.
That's
no
right.
dreaded double F this week.
So I have another solution here.
Okay.
It's much more radical. Should we think about not doing busing anymore for kids?
Ooh.
I mean, in this time of economic hardship, I mean,
how do you want to get the 5-year-olds to school?
Private school, you know, the parents could drive them. I guess that wouldn't be good for the environment. They could walk.
Well, what if they live more
walking would not be good for school choice, would it?
Mike, what if 5-year-olds live more than like a mile and a half from their school and their parents?
All right. But I don't know. Maybe more kids could walk. But this is always...
Want 5-year-olds walking even a mile and a half to school? Come on.
Well, they got those little scooters now. They got those sneakers with those wheels in them.
When Nico is 5, I think you're singing a different song, baby. That's all I'm saying.
All right. Well, that is all the time we have for this week. Thanks for joining us. Again, don't forget, let your friends know about the Education Gadfly Show. Become a fan on Facebook. Spread the word. Until next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Education Gadfly Show, brought to you from the Thomas B. Fordham Institute at edexcellence.net. Signing off.